Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Afua Hirsch.
I'm Peter Frankopan.
And in our podcast, Legacy, we explore the lives of some of the biggest characters in history.
This season, we're exploring the life of Cleopatra.
An iconic life full of romances, sieges, and tragedy. But who was the real Cleopatra? It feels like her story's been told by others with their own agenda for centuries.
But her legacy is enduring, and so we're going to dive into how her story has evolved all the way up to today.
I am so excited to talk about Cleopatra, Peter.
Love Cleopatra.
She is an icon.
She's the most famous woman in antiquity. It's got to be up there with the most famous woman of all time.
But I think there's a huge gap between how familiar people are with the idea of her compared to what they actually know about her life and character.
So for pyramids, Cleopatra and Cleopatra's nose.
Follow Legacy now wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can binge entire seasons early and ad-free on Wondery Plus.
Hello everyone, welcome to Dan Snow's History. I've got a BAFTA award winning actor, comedian, broadcaster, and now history author on the podcast today, David Mitchell, national treasure here in the UK for his acting in the hit TV show Peep Show, and he's gone on to many wonderful projects after that. His latest project, though, is a history book, a history of England, kings and queens. From the emergence of England, which, as you'll hear, we have a little discussion about, he locates it sometime during Athelstan's reign. Others might say Edgar. Who knows? The debate goes on. Right the way up to 1600 with the passing of the Tudors. He is interested in kings and queens when they wielded power. But his book is informative, but it's also funny. It's a cross-genre book, folks. He points out that the Vikings were great, unless you met them. A bit like Peter Sellers. And I expect he is right. Very pleased that this former history student at Cambridge University has come home to history after decades wasting his time in comedy. The history world's lucky to have him back. So here's David Mitchell. Enjoy.
T-minus 10.
Atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima.
God save the king.
No black-white unity till there is first some black unity.
Never to go to war with one another again.
And liftoff, and the shuttle has cleared the tower.
Hi, folks. Welcome to this live recording of Dan Snow's History Hit podcast. It's live because we've got one of our biggest guests ever, David Mitchell, star of stage and screen. David, how are you?
Oh, very well, thank you.
Well, it's good to have you.
When now, you what? Say live, this isn't live.
No, it's not live.
No. Live recording.
Did I say live?
Yeah, it's a live recording.
Well, I mean,
that's actually a contradiction in terms.
Well,
we're live now.
We may be dead
by the time people
live.
Watch this.
It's now live.
Yeah.
There'll be no editing. We can't afford editors.
No.
To what do we owe this great treat? Why are you a colossus delving into our little world of history? What's going on?
I've written a history book.
I know.
Yeah. That's why I'm here.
No, but why? Why have you done that?
Because
we assume you could be bestriding the stage and being funny on, you know, much bigger platforms than our little geeky world.
What platform could be bigger than the entire history of human endeavour?
Well, that's what I secretly say.
I started writing this book during the lockdown when a lot of people are trying to write things and I hadn't been. And then I started typing about the Vikings because it occurred to me that COVID is a bit like the Vikings in that it was a terrible thing that suddenly happened to an unsuspecting community. In the case of my typing, Anglo-Saxon England. They were being Anglo-Saxon England in their way, and it wasn't a great life, but, you know, they were used to it. And then suddenly the Vikings turned up, and it was grim. And they didn't know why. They didn't know whether they'd stop turning up, whether they'd go away, and just thought that's the one of the bleakest things about being a human being. Sometimes a bit of history just happens to you and there's nothing you can do and you're a victim of it and you're not part of it and you don't have agency. And the Anglo-Saxons, as we did, tried to give themselves some agency by saying it was their fault And, you know, have all the talk about, yes, with COVID, we haven't been preparing enough for pandemics, or that somebody maybe ate a bat or whatever, you know, whatever it was. Let's please, as humanity, let's take ownership of it and make it something we've done to ourselves, rather than the more frightening thing, which is just something that's happening to us that has nothing to do with us and makes us not a villain, but just a victim. And that's what happened with the Vikings turning, and the Anglo-Saxons said, oh, it's God's cross with us. We haven't been praying enough. We haven't been holy enough. That wasn't why. It was just because that, you know, the socioeconomic conditions in Scandinavia shifted slightly, as did maritime technology.
Yeah, mate, yeah. You can't control the waters around the island, David, as we know. You know, that's the ongoing problem in British history. So you...
It used to be Vikings, now it's sewage.
That's a good point. Then they try. I've got images now of the monks on Lindisfarne attempting to sort of enforce social distancing. Sorry, can we just...
Well, it's the ultimate social distancing, just going to Lindisfarne, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, exactly. They've been practicing it for generations.
But yeah, the poor guys, they were sitting there all quiet, praying away, and then the Vikings turned up.
In their case, so that's history. Why kings and queens? Why do we return? It's so interesting. We return time and again to this. Does it give us a track and narrative that we can then write, hang on the rest of British history onto?
I think so. I think for me, certainly in the medieval period that my book's about, that's the basic political narrative, the who's in charge narrative. And that doesn't tell the full story, but it tells one of the main stories, and it leads you through it. And that was the story I had found most compelling before, and the one I was interested to tell. And it's, you know, in many ways, there are more important things to look at in terms of the lives of the majority of the people. But in terms of characters and story, that's what I was drawn to. And you can't also, one of the reasons my book ends in 1603, and one of the reasons is that after that, if you just talk about the kings and queens, that becomes less and less relevant, and that stops being even the main political story after 100 years or so.
I think that's so true, because if we're in this poll, we're going to try and get a bit of a pecking order going. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's so hard to compare medieval monarchs with early modern and modern ones, because you end up having to like go, well, was Elizabeth II better than Athelstan? And you're like, it is just, you're comparing two totally different entities, aren't you?
I certainly feel that if they swapped roles, they'd both be very unhappy. I think if Elizabeth II was trying to consolidate Anglo-Saxon control on a partly Viking-occupied island, I don't think that would have been her great strength. And similarly, I think he might have found it a bit frustrating, the endless duty and positivity, and he might just... some point, can I slash someone to bits with a sword? Go, no, Your Majesty, just now take the posy of flowers and smile.
I think that is totally true. So that makes life a bit easier. And when did you started writing about the Vikings?
Yeah.
You must have found writing this book, whenever I write and think about kings and queens, this our bizarre habit of starting the king list with William the Conqueror. It just is so strange, isn't it? And you've gone all the way back to the early medieval as well, haven't you?
Well, I thought if we're going to define a book, one of the ways you could define it is say it's about the kings and queens of England. And so you immediately say, okay, so England has to exist. And England didn't exist. I mean, obviously the physical space did, but no one called it England before the Anglo-Saxons arrived, because that term derives from then. So we can forget about the Romans. Or not forget about them, but, you know, don't have to do the Romans. And similarly, after Elizabeth I, you got the same monarchy in charge of England and Scotland. And so it starts to be more Britain. And I didn't want to pretend that England was Britain. I'm explicitly not doing the history of Scotland, which is separate. It impacts, I mention it. But if I said, okay, I'll do it of the kings and queens of Britain, you're opening up so many other arenas. And so
you've got to put the Bruce in there.
Either the book is much longer or it's much less detailed.
So you, okay, well, this is the big problem we all face, isn't it? Is who was the first king of England?
Yes.
It's a nightmare.
Well, it might be Athelstan. Yeah. It might be Edward the Elder. It's not Alfred the Great.
Sadly not.
But it's around then. As I say in the book, it's a sort of soft launch, the Kingdom of England. Before the Vikings came, the Anglo-Saxons definitely had lots of different kingdoms and a vague sense that they're from the same cultural root, but no real sense that the notion of England is really forged in opposition to the Vikings. They sort of, we want to get back to England, was the sort of Alfred the great pitch, but there was no England to really get back to before. So,
when you started this project, you mentioned you started from the kind of point of view of the Vikings. Yeah. But did you think, oh, I'm going to write a history of English monarchy, it's going to be very heavily kind of Plantagenet-y, and were you kind of drawn towards those early monarchs? I find them increasingly interesting, only because we overlooked them until quite recently. They just weren't part of our kind of national story.
I like it because it's so confusing.
Definitely.
You know, that you understand why there's been so much televising of the Tudors. You sort of know where you are. There's a handful of easy characters to get a grip on.
You can assume a bit of knowledge in the audience. Everyone knows where they are.
But the Wars of the Roses, it's all over the place. Even since writing the book, I've forgotten most of it.
Okay,
but
great.
But the Plantagenets going into cadet branches of York and Lancaster, that's the big muddle of what basically happened in medieval England that I used writing this book to briefly get a sort of grip on. But the confusingness of it is attractive. And that's what all kingship is. Our notion of kings is partly Henry VIII, but apart from his big iconic figure, we're thinking of kings that were in that period. That's the proper period of kings. That's when all of the aesthetic of kingship derives from that time.
Yeah, that's interesting. When individual, usually men, ruled with pretty arbitrary, pretty total power over all the rest of us.
Yes.
And they had crowns.
They had crowns, they had shields, they had coats of arms. All of the pictures of King Arthur have him like that, even though if he had existed, which he didn't, he was a millennium earlier and would have had very, very different clobber. Probably a bit of an old toga, you know.
Yeah, clinging on to the remnant of
half a gladius and a sandal, saying, I am the emperor.
Is writing a history book, is that one of the dad sort of things to tick off? You know, like it's dad life, hashtag dad life. Because, I mean, you could have done so many different things. So many of my friends like come to history in the middle years of their life. But you've got previous. It strikes me that one of your more famous alter egos, someone who you've had to struggle in the past to put distance between you and this fictional person. He wanted to write a book called Business Secrets of Pharaohs.
Yes. Well, I can't say that I've entirely escaped the shadow of Mark Corrigan in writing a history book. This is a book that he might be interested in.
Well, I think so.
But the thing is about him and me, we were young fogies, and now I'm gradually growing into the appropriate age for fogies.
That's as another young fogey. It's quite nice because all your friends suddenly join. You don't move. You remain as interested in Stalingrad as you were at 19.
Yeah.
But strangely, your sort of weird mates who are interested in like house music and other things start to, then sometimes surpass you. Like I've got mates now who are like writing detailed descriptions of their grandfather at the Battle of Passchendaele. I'm like, you've overshot the runway. Yeah.
Yes. What's your music collection looking like now?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So let's talk. When you did this book, I'm so interested. I love people's different perspectives on all the monarchs. Can we just start with, like, anything you are just sick of and you think are massively overrated?
Well, I'm not keen on William the Conqueror.
Okay.
I'm not keen on William the Conqueror, and I'm not keen on Edward the Confessor.
Well,
now, I wouldn't say Edward the Confessor is massively overrated, but
no one likes him.
We call him. Well, I'm very glad to hear it, because it seems like lots of people like him. They allow him to call himself Edward the Confessor and talk about his holiness and his praying.
Absolutely useless man.
He was a useless man.
Totally.
He sowed the seeds of discord.
Absolutely. Do we not like William the Conqueror because you have a kind of nostalgic love for the Anglo-Saxon, sort of all a bit 19th century, a bit nostalgic for that? Or do you just think he was a right bastard who was just a violent psychopath?
Well, they were all right bastards, basically. In terms of the standard of conduct is woefully below what we'd expect, you know, even of Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't imagine a prime minister behaving like that, with that level of incompetence, that level of promiscuity. It'd be absolutely shocking this day and age, wouldn't it?
No, yes, we just have a much higher. But the truth is, we do. Even the worst, even Liz Truss is probably a safer pair of hands than most
Goodness
of these
me.
People.
Okay.
But certainly was less interested in waging war. And crucially, you could get rid of her without waiting for her to die. And that is a very, very good system.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there were so many times in the Middle Ages where people were just waiting for this useless bastard to die. And then very occasionally they go, well, it could be ages, even though it's the Middle Ages and people just drop dead for no reason all the time. We just can't wait for him to die. We're going to have to do something else.
Edward II, I'm sorry. Yeah.
It's just too long. Just, he might not die for 30 years.
Yeah, we can't.
His father made old bones.
His dad made old bones, and his son did all. Yeah,
Richard II, similarly. Yeah. It's going to be too long before he dies. We're just going to have to put him in a castle and starve him.
So William the Conqueror, yeah. You don't like him because you're affectionate.
You've got to pick a side, right?
I mean,
that may be that some academic historians would say you don't.
I think possibly.
But I think they've lost, they've lost the joy. But I think if Battle of Hastings, one of the first things you get taught about, or I got taught about, you've got to pick a side. Do you want to pick the invading Normans, or do you want to pick the Harold sitting on Senlac Hill? And I picked Harold. Most of the people in my class picked Harold. But turns out, sadly, spoiler alert for people who haven't yet bought the book, Harold loses.
Crikey.
And that's a bit of a shame. And it's one of the good reasons not to start your history of the kings and queens of England with William the Conqueror, because it's a bit of a pisser.
Harold's an attractive character, I think.
Yeah, he's very, obviously he had no birthright to be king. We feel more relaxed about that now, that we're not so keen on the whole notion of people being in charge because of a birthright. But he was professional. He was organised. He did everything right. And he would have won the Battle of Hastings if his army had listened to him.
And his brother, Tostig, was obviously such a horrible person. Yeah. Harold got rid of him.
We all know families can be difficult. And I feel for Harold trying to deal with Tostig. And he's got a nice earldom in the north. Things are going nicely for him. But he pushes his luck. And I think Harold deals with it with great dignity.
You listen to Dan Snow's History. Talking to David Mitchell about kings and queens of England. He's just written a book called Unruly. More coming up.
This is After Dark, Myths, Misdeeds and the Paranormal.
The podcast that takes you to the shadiest corners of the past, unpicking history's spookiest, strangest and most sinister stories. I'm Maddie Pelling.
And I'm Anthony Delaney. Join us every Monday and Thursday and we'll take a look at the darker side of history, from haunted pubs to Houdini to witch trials and arsenic-laced breakfasts.
Follow After Dark, Myths, Misdeeds and the Paranormal wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
So you're a Harold fan.
Yeah.
You are not a William fan. Anyone else overrated?
I think the Tudors in general are overrated because they're not, their imagery is great. The portraits of Henry VIII and Elizabeth I in particular, that's great iconography. And you sort of think, we can do that. They've got the outfit at Angels. Get the right actor, stick them in that. That's a great trailer. But they're a bit of an afterthought of medieval kingship, really. And I think in their time, England is essentially accepting its own mediocrity. Henry VIII, it's got to be said, he's been overcovered, but he is a lot of fun. I understand why he's had so much coverage and in a way looked at in terms of if you take the job of a king not to be to rule his own age, but to give lots of interesting stories to posterity, he has been an amazing content provider. And I do accept that he's fun, but I've had a bit of enough of him. And also, if you think about him for more than 5 minutes, he was so awful, unbearable. Yeah. You know, almost you'd rather a complete tyrant. But the fact that he had a sort of an intelligent, thoughtful, intellectual side to him almost makes his tantrums and his
crushing insecurity.
Yeah, all the more contemptible.
So you're a blood and thunder guy. I mean, you like a king. Was it Henry IV of Navarre and of France said, I rule with my arse in my saddle and my sword in my hand. That's your archetype.
Well, that was the way to do it. That's what Henry II did, and he's one of the most effective medieval monarchs, albeit one who sort of met with a sad, lonely end.
Yeah.
Henry I was great, and he's a professional.
I agree.
He
got rid of his brothers.
Yeah. He usurped the throne brutally which is,
you know. No, that was a terribly unfortunate hunting accident in the New Forest where poor Prince Harry saw his older brother William get killed very accidentally and not on purpose at all.
Well, he definitely bounced back quickly from his grief and got in ahead of his poor, the elder brother. I mean,
One of life's losers, one of history's losers.
Robert Curtos, who died, he was made very old bones, but spent most of his life in Cardiff Castle.
Yeah.
And, you know, Cardiff wasn't the vibrant centre then that it is now. So, I feel sorry for him. But no, Henry I, he just feels like he's professional. He got it. What you have to do, you have to be horrible. They were all horrible. You have to be willing to kill at a moment's notice. But if you do it with a rationale, you do it even-handedly, you don't have favourites, and you have some notion of the stable government you want to be heading towards, then it can work out. And he created a very peaceful kingdom, albeit through violence. And in those days, that's sort of as good as it gets. And also, another thing he doesn't do that many of the other ones that vie for best king, they all do, is he didn't try and conquer too many other places. That puts a lot of pressure on the kingdom when the hundreds of years where every king of England is trying also to be king of France, and it's not really viable. But he said, no, I've got Normandy and England, and I'm going to stick.
Happy days.
Yeah.
And Ireland, the Irish Ulster, the appalling result of that conquest. Wales wasn't easy. Mm. And as you say, France. But I mean, Henry V, Britain's Alexander, what a legend. But he died of dysentery after a siege. Because as you say, I guess it's those conquests put pressure on the institution and money and stuff. Also on the individuals. I mean, it's exhausting. And Richard I got shot with a crossbow bolt during a siege as well.
So. Yes, and he was, they say he was pausing to applaud the bravery of the castle's defenders. And just go, well done, he was just defending the castle with a frying pan. And he thought, how brave that is. But he may be on the other side, but I applaud my fellow. Ah!
A kid.
Yeah.
And then,
and then thanks to the complete absence of knowledge of how to medically treat a wound, he just died agonisingly over a fortnight.
That's a terrible description, isn't it? Yeah, it took him a long time to go. Okay, so Tudor's overrated, William the Conqueror's overrated. Anybody else that you came to really think was... Elizabeth Tudor usually tops the list, doesn't she, Elizabeth I?
I suppose she is overrated. She wasn't amazing.
I struggle with her, because sometimes I think, God, what a mate, and all that kind of clever politics. And then partly you think, well, Ireland was a disaster. She didn't solve any of the big problems. She delayed all the big problems. Didn't seem to solve any of them. So I struggle with her.
Well, the thing about her that people don't seem to say, but strikes me, and it's a success of her brand building that people don't say it, is she was just very, very cautious.
Yeah.
And she inherited the throne at a time where she was the daughter of Anne Boleyn. The country is hugely divided, religiously speaking. She was in an extremely insecure position and had a tricky life up to then. So I understand the caution. It's an intelligent person's response. But she sort of knew she was on a sticky wicket and behaved like it, really. And she was, repelling the Armada went well, but everything she actively pushed out into the world was essentially underfunded and nervously done.
Well, and she underfunded the poor old sailors who fought in the Armada as well, to their great detriment. So,
well, she sort of launched her own Armada, didn't she?
Oh, yeah, the
following years later, that went at least as bad.
We forgot that one. Yeah. So Henry I, interesting. I think I agree with that. Dare I ask, have we got top three?
Well, I'd have to. I think Henry II was pretty amazing.
I think so too.
And he held together. I mean, most of France as well as England, and it's all down to energy. I think he wasn't great at dealing with his own family because the relentlessness with which his sons tried to overthrow him, to me, it suggests that he must have been a difficult chap, you know, domestically speaking, because that doesn't always happen. Didn't happen to Edward III, who had a very good relationship with his kids, despite by the end of his reign, he was totally decrepit, but nobody was trying to overthrow him, whereas Henry II, they were trying to overthrow him the whole time when he was still quite... you know, hale and hearty.
So we like Henry first and second.
Yeah. But I'm wondering about the big two in terms of trying to conquer France are Henry V and Edward III.
Yeah.
What do you think about the two?
Well, it's interesting. They're both supreme military leaders.
Yeah.
Probably the best two. Richard, okay.
Richard Lionheart's very good.
Richard Lionheart's very good. Extraordinary. Very good. But as you say, ultimately, those
plots just bankrupt. Well, and in case Henry V destroyed his dynasty, because Henry VI, his son, was just sort of completely broken by that effort and the effort to hold in France. And then with the third, yeah, it's a hubristic thing to do, undertaking, isn't it?
Well, the thing is, they both tried with all their might to take over France, and they both nearly succeeded. But the whole notion of trying to take over France is so ridiculous that can you count them great kings? For that they've devoted themselves to something that was just, it was a horrible experience for both of the armies. And the poor French, you sort of think about all these, the famous battles of the Hundred Years' War, Poitiers, Crecy and Agincourt, these great victories where outnumbered English armies destroy huge French armies because the French armies have got a ridiculous strategy. It makes the English the underdogs and it makes us feel all good and plucky. But the reality is all of this is happening in France. The reason the English are so outnumbered is that they have left home in order to destroy the lives, livelihoods, crops and villages of people in a neighbouring country who've done them no harm. So that suddenly slightly turns around the whole plucky underdog thing to say, no, what they are is nasty thieving bandits. And, you know, sometimes a burglar will be in a house and find himself outnumbered by the people that live there. But that doesn't make him plucky.
And in both cases, Edward III's successor and Henry V's successor, both partly as results, deposed.
Yes.
So, yeah, damaging for their dynasties. So we're not huge fans of trying to conquer France.
Even though, obviously, Henry II, who I've just named, he was obviously controlled a lot of France.
Yeah,
but he wasn't trying to be king of France.
Yeah, he married the King of France's wife, which was a shots fired. But yeah. What about Edward I? Feels like we haven't...
Well, I'm quite judgmental about him in the book, because obviously he was militarily quite successful and basically asserted control over Wales, which was not necessarily what all Welsh people would say was nice, but it was his aim. So he succeeded in his aim. But he also had the same aim with Scotland, and he didn't succeed in that remotely. And in fact, the enmity between England and Scotland had existed for a long time afterwards. And you can see certainly remnants of in the way people from Scotland, people from England relate to each other now, was hugely inflamed by his very unsuccessful policy. And I think he was a bit of a sort of thug, really, a thoughtless...
You know,
he was a big religious extremist. He was very, very devout. And one of the things he did as a result was expel all the Jews from England, which, you know, was very fashionable amongst extreme Christians at the time. But, you know, it's not something we look fondly on now.
I think you're setting quite a difficult set of parameters, because you like a thug... But you don't. You don't want them to be. You like them to be sort of thuggish within a kind of national community, rather than invading the next door one.
Yes. Well, I think what I'm expecting. Firstly, you say I like a thug. I think the thuggish nature of government then was regrettable.
Yeah.
But it's all thuggish. Yeah. So you can choose the sort of bonkers thugs that you don't know what they're going to do next, the more even-handed thugs, the thugs that fail in their aims, the more successful thugs. And so on the basis that they're all thugs, I'm picking the even-handed successful thugs over the unsuccessful capricious thugs.
That's very clear. So Henry I, who else do we like? Who's the thuggish? Oh, Henry II. So Henry I, Henry II.
Yeah.
I have a soft spot for Henry III, who I don't think was thuggish enough. But
he certainly, his worst enemy wouldn't call him a thug. You're right. No. Henry III and indeed Richard II and Ethelred the Unready, the unusual thing, a medieval king that doesn't really want to go to war.
Henry VI.
And Henry VI, he's another one. I mean, he had more problems than that. But that, you know, nowadays, we don't want our leaders starting wars. In those days, if you didn't want to ride into battle, it's a big part of the job description that you're not willing to cover. And they didn't go. It's odd, very odd with Richard II, actually, because he was avoided war throughout his largely unsuccessful reign. But the first thing he did, where he sort of faced down the peasants' revolt, was incredibly brave.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't necessarily expect him to be a reluctant general from that moment. But
we've talked a lot about war. Is there anything else you've identified? What makes good king or queen? I mean, the organised violence side of it aside, is there anything else?
I think all of the things that we expect from government today, you've just got to ignore that. They're not trying for any of it. They're not trying for peace. On the contrary, they're waging war. In terms of education and healthcare, they're not interested. Forget about it. So all you can expect is stability. The good kings provide stability, the bad kings don't. And the stability comes from being predictable in your actions and firm and not having favourites. And I think, you know, Henry I was particularly good at that. He's even-handed. He didn't have a clique. The worst kings, the ones that caused the most trouble, Richard II, Edward II, Henry VI, have favourites. And it's having favourites, having particular people they leant upon that made the rest of the nobility feel sidelined and frightened. That's what causes civil war, and that's what essentially makes living in medieval England even less unpleasant than it usually was.
Isn't it interesting, when I'm reading a book or thinking about this, how you're talking about kingship, like they don't have human bodies themselves. So I now, as I get older, I realise how different I am at various different stages in my life. Mm. And these people, as you mentioned, like Edward III, they're trying to be Edward III, but...
Yeah.
You can be Edward III as a young man, but then you've also got to be Edward III as a guy crippled with musculoskeletal pain. And, it's fascinating, isn't it? How they age and then that changes the nature of their rule.
Yes. And perhaps we expect too much of them. Yeah. And one of the biggest mistakes I think Henry I made was at the end of his reign, when he caused a rift between himself and Geoffrey of Anjou and Matilda, his daughter, who was, his designated heir. And because he basically refused to give Geoffrey some castles that had been promised to him. And that is an old man clinging on to all of his possessions and telling himself he's frightened that if he gives these castles to Geoffrey, that that's going to start Geoffrey trying to take over Normandy, which I think there's no evidence for at all. The fear he's feeling really is of death. But he projects that onto his son-in-law. And as a result of that rift, that gave Stephen, the next king, the excuse to claim that Henry I didn't really want Matilda to inherit the throne. And that causes 20 years of civil war. And that's the product of the changing mentality of an aging man. And obviously Edward III, he completely outlived his faculties, and that was a shame as well. He'd been this great general and quite a good leader and clearly an effective father because his family liked him and had a strong marriage with his queen, but then she died and he starts to lose his grip and is very much in the thrall of his lover, and the country starts going bankrupt because he's still trying to fight a war in France. And it's a very, very sad end to a very glorious reign.
I think wives are important and they're often overlooked, aren't they? I think Henry I had a very good wife and Henry II had a remarkable wife. Those are some of the details that, that we can ignore, perhaps, as traditionally men have written about them through the kind of military lens.
Yeah. And we don't hear so much about the Queen's, the Queen's consort. But...
I think they probably played a really important role. Last question, I guess. Did you, when you're sitting there in modern Britain, writing away, do you think these men and women, did they matter? Like, the older I get, the more absolute. Or is it all just science and engineering and microbes? And do you think that the people in charge make a difference?
Yes, I wish I knew. They definitely.
I'm expecting an actual comprehensive answer right now.
They definitely make a difference in the short term. But here's the big question in terms of the period I've done. You've got, for a long time in the Anglo-Saxon period, all the relationships from England are with Scandinavian kingdoms because of the Vikings. And you have King Canute, who basically rules England and much of Scandinavia. And it sort of feels like that's England's orbit. And then suddenly, a few of the right people die and that all changes. And William the Conqueror comes over and England's orbit is all France. And then you have Henry II and, it's almost like the whole direction the country's looking in swivels round. Was that inevitable? Would that have happened if we know...
If Canute's kids hadn't been so bloody useless.
Well, yes, if he'd had more effective heirs or if William the Conqueror had lost at Hastings, which could easily have happened. Harold the Godwinson, very much more Scandinavian looking. Would that trend have continued? Or was the impact on England of Normandy and by extension France inevitable? That cultural power was a force beyond the control of any man or men. Without William the Conqueror, would the Anglo-Saxon royal house still have basically been dealing with France 100 years later. Yeah. And you see how I've avoided answering your question just reposing it.
What a pro.
I could be a politician, couldn't I?
You should be. Yeah. You're wasted. Best monarch to go for a beer with?
Monarch to go for a beer with, I think, young Henry VIII.
Oh, okay.
I think young Henry VIII, he'd be good company, but I wouldn't trust him. Quite into modern, thoughtful ways of doing things. And then he just hurt his leg and got cross for 20 years.
Best monarch to be your brother-in-law, to marry your sister?
To marry your sister?
To have in the family is a sort of, in-law, nice in-law relationship.
I think that is an incredibly specific question.
Yes.
Best Edward IV.
Mm.
Yeah.
Bit of a shagger.
He was a bit of a shagger. I tell you what, he did for his wife's family.
Oh, okay. That's a very good way of looking at it.
Absolutely showered them with wealth. But also, I think Edward IV is slightly underrated as well. Because he was quite capable.
If David Mitchell's sister is listening to this podcast, you are there.
I don't have a sister.
Well, there you go. That's why. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. She is there simply to bring honours and jewels upon the rest of the family. I love it.
I think they would have said that family that he made an okay brother-in-law. Yeah,
that's true. And then his little brother came along and had them all killed.
Yeah.
Best monarch to go on a stag night team-building exercise on a windswept island off the coast.
Right. Now, what do you want from someone like that? You're on a team-building. I mean, if you're me, you want the monarch will guide you to the latest pub the nearest pub that has nice rooms so you can avoid the
Henry
whole
the
team
navigator.
Building yeah. exercise. And so, yeah, I don't know. I think maybe, you see, Edward IV would be quite good for that sort of thing. He liked his creature comforts. I mean, they killed him in the end. I'm going to try and think of someone. Richard the Lionheart.
Okay.
There you go.
Yeah.
He was good at logistics. I think if you could say, tell him it was the holy thing to do, you need to say, we need to go on a crusade to find the pub.
Yeah, he did well on Cyprus, which is an island, so there, I guess.
Yeah.
David Mitchell, thank you very much for coming on this show. What is the book called?
It's called Unruly. It does all of the kings of England from the Anglo-Saxons to Elizabeth I.
All of your medieval kingship needs will be met.
And it has colour photography.
What?
Yeah, although no photographs of the actual kings and queens, sadly. But that's because photography wasn't invented in time. It's not my fault.
Yeah, the picture, it's not the picture to sort of...
No, exactly. Yeah. So instead you have the dreadful drawings that were done of them by various medieval monks.
Very good. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.